This podcast is supported by the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, one of America's leading medical research schools. How will advances in artificial intelligence transform medical research and medical care? To find out, we invite you to read a special supplement to Science Magazine prepared by Icon Mount Sinai in partnership with Science. Just visit our website at science.org and search for Frontiers of Medical Research-Artificial Intelligence. On May 1st and May 2nd, Icon Mount Sinai and the New York Academy of Sciences will be convening a major symposium in New York City on the new wave of AI in healthcare. For more information and to register, please visit events.nyas.org/AI Health. That's events.nyas.org/AI Health. The Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. We find a way. This week's episode is brought to you in part by the NOMIS and Science Young Explorer Award. Are you doing excellent research that deserves recognition? The NOMIS and Science Young Explorer Award recognizes bold young researchers who ask fundamental questions at the intersection of the life and social sciences. Researchers who take risks to address relevant and exciting questions with creative approaches, regardless of the research outcome. Submissions are due May 15th. Visit science.org/NOMIS, that's N-O-M-I-S, to apply today. Welcome to the Science Podcast for July 24th, 2015. I'm Sarah Crespi. In this week's show, Elizabeth Culotta talks about the ancient DNA revolution, and David Grimm is here with some of our latest online news stories.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Now we have David Grimm, editor for our daily news site. He's here to talk about some recent online stories. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story on the rise of autism in the U.S. I think few would doubt that there has been a sudden increase in autism diagnosis in children in the U.S. But many of us are probably wondering why this is happening. Is it becoming so common because of an underlying cause, or has there been a shift in diagnosis? So, Dave, what do the numbers say?
Well, Sarah, from 2000 to 2010, there was more than tripling of U.S. school children diagnosed with autism. At the same time, there was a steep decline in the number of kids that were diagnosed with an intellectual disability. So this suggests that maybe there's been a shift in the way autism has been diagnosed.
Where are these numbers coming from?
Well, the researchers in this study collected data from about 6.2 million school children across the U.S. These were kids that were enrolled in special education programs. Now, these kids had a whole host of issues, not just autism, but learning disabilities, epilepsy, blindness, other types of disabilities. And the question was, why is the number of autism cases in this group increased so much over time?
Why do the researchers think that we're seeing a decline in people categorized as having intellectual disability and an increase in people categorized or children categorized as having autism?
Well, the simple answer is that a lot of things we used to call intellectual disability were probably actually autism. Now we're just a lot better at diagnosing autism than we were in the past. The other issue is that autism used to be a very stigmatized disorder. Now there's a lot more acceptance of it. Doctors aren't as afraid perhaps to diagnose it. Parents are perhaps more accepting of that diagnosis because at least they know what's going on. So I think we've seen a few factors that have contributed. The bottom line really is that autism isn't really going up. The rates are probably similar to what they've been in the past. It's just that we're a lot better at spotting it than we were in the past.
Next up, we have a story on the risks of swimming in shark-infested waters. The story is just a little late for Shark Week, but that's not our fault. Shark Week jumped a whole month earlier this year. The question this study is trying to answer, though, is how likely am I to get bitten by a shark if I swim or surf off the coast of California? So, Dave, how safe is it out there?
It's safer than you think, and especially safer than you think considering the numbers. The problem is that shark attacks have actually gone up over the past 60 years or so, at least off the California coast. But your actual risk of being bitten by a shark has gone down.
Okay, break it down for me more.
Well, when researchers analyzed the data from this about 60-year period, they saw an increase of about 0.9 to 1.5 attacks per year. Now, that sounds like a bad thing. However, at the same time, the number of beachgoers really exploded from 53 million in the 1950s to 165 million in 2013, a more than 200% increase. Now, what does that all mean? That means there's a lot more people in the water, which means if you are one of those people, your chances of being bitten are actually about 91% lower than they were 63 years ago.
The chances are lower, but there are more attacks, 0.9 versus 1.5 per year. Is that because there are just so many people crammed into the water, or are sharks doing anything differently?
One reason may be that shark numbers are rebounding. There have been some conservation efforts to bring back some of these populations. The other thing is that there's been also recovery of the animals that sharks prey on, seals and sea lions. So there's more reason for sharks to stay in these waters. When they're staying in these waters, they're not just seeing seals and sea lions. They're seeing people as well.
Can this data set tell us when or where it's safe to swim?
Yeah, that's the great thing about it. I mean, the researchers basically say, first of all, we want to make people aware that it's a lot safer than they think it is out there, but also that we should really be dealing in real-world data. And this data, especially if people really educate themselves, can tell them the best times potentially to go in the water, areas to avoid as well.
Lastly, we have a story on tiny cloud makers. As scientists try to model and predict climate change through better observation and measurement, they run into one big roadblock. What did things look like before we were around to muck them up? Sometimes researchers, you know, try to look through the past by looking at ice core samples, that kind of thing. Other times they go to untouched regions to serve as models for the past. So, Dave, where do researchers look when they want to see a place untouched by climate change?
Well, they go to the Southern Ocean. This is the ocean that sort of surrounds Antarctica. It's in the southern part of the globe, as you would expect. It's also a very stormy, very kind of inhospitable place. So people typically don't spend a lot of time there, which really allows scientists to look at a part of the world that's pretty much untouched by human hands.
And researchers are looking at cloud formation over the Southern Ocean. What's so complicated about clouds and climate change? Why do they need to look there?
Well, first of all, this is a very cloudy part of Earth. It's actually the cloudiest region on Earth. More than 90% of the sky is clouded for most of the year. And the reason we care about clouds is because clouds can actually have a couple different and actually opposite effects on the climate. If the clouds are low in the sky, they actually bounce solar radiation back into space. So they basically bounce sunlight off the Earth, which helps cool the planet. But the clouds that are higher in the sky actually trap heat, and that makes the Earth warm up. So knowing where clouds form, how they form, is really important for climate modeling.
Let's get to the data here. What did scientists actually do to better understand cloud formation here in the southern latitudes?
Well, one of the ways clouds form is there are aerosols, these tiny little particles that float up into the atmosphere. Water droplets can condense around these aerosols, and that process can snowball until you have a cloud. There's also been some suspicion that tiny marine life can also see clouds as well. And that was the point in this new study, because you have a lot of these tiny marine organisms called phytoplankton. And the question was, are these tiny organisms, which are really all over the Southern Ocean, could they be contributing to cloud formation in the region? So to figure out what was happening here, the researchers looked at a couple different pieces of data. They looked at data from NASA's Terra satellite, which looks at basically cloud formation in the atmosphere over a broad swath of the Southern Ocean. They also looked at the concentrations of chlorophyll A in the water. And this chlorophyll serves as a proxy for biological activity. The more of these phytoplankton you have in the water, the more chlorophyll A. And what they found was a real strong correlation between the amount of phytoplankton and the amount of cloud formation.
So there's a strong link between the presence of these little guys and the presence of clouds. Do the researchers know how exactly they may be causing clouds to form?
I think there may be a couple things going on. One is that these phytoplankton emit dimethyl sulfide gas. And in the atmosphere, this gas chemically transforms into sulfate, which is a highly efficient cloud condensation nucleus, which basically means it just makes it easier for clouds to form. The second way is through sea spray. It turns out that organic matter in the ocean collects on the skins of tiny bubbles in surface waves. And when the waters churn the sea spray into the atmosphere, they also send up these loaded bubbles, which can also serve as cloud nuclei.
Okay, what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, if you've ever wanted to see a snake with four legs, you'll have the chance to see that and read a story about it on the site. Also, we are continuing our Pluto coverage. There's going to be some new images released this week, and we'll be analyzing them. Also, a bit of behind the scenes of what happened in Pluto Mission Control last week, some fun stories that emerged there. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about a new report that is urging the National Institutes of Health to lessen the biomedical scientist glut. Also, a new $100 million initiative to search for alien life. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org. Ancient DNA is just what it sounds like. Really, really old DNA. So old that for a long time, scientists thought it was irretrievably lost. As new techniques have become available, researchers can now examine whole genomes of long-extinct animals and plants. I spoke with news editor Elizabeth Culotta about this week's special section on ancient DNA.
So we decided to do this issue now because we realized that there are so many papers in this field right now. I am mostly a news editor at Science, and it's my job to kind of track papers in this field, and I have a great team of reporters who helps me do it. And we realized that there are so many papers now coming out in ancient DNA. It's our job to track them, and we can hardly keep up. I mean, every single week there is something new happening. And in fact, this very week, there are two papers in Science related to this, and these came up quite quickly. One is about who killed the megafauna, the giant animals and grazers that were living in the northern latitudes right around the Ice Age and vanished when humans came. And the other one is how the Americas were peopled. So there's two papers in Science this week in addition to our special issue.
Methods of extracting and sequencing ancient DNA have been around since the 1980s. What have been the major milestones in this technique's development?
This technique started, as you said, in the 1980s, and after the first successes, they had some problems with contamination. And by contamination, I mean contamination with modern DNA. So they were sequencing what they thought were ancient samples, but they realized that what they were getting was contamination from, say, a lab technician's finger or from a bacteria floating around in the laboratory. So that was a real problem for the field. However, around the early 2000s, a new way of sequencing came out. It's called next-generation sequencing, and it is great for a number of reasons for ancient DNA. For starters, it does things faster and cheaper, so you can sequence more things quickly. But also, it offers you a new way to deal with this contamination problem. With these new next-generation methods, the researchers can prepare their samples in such a way that they can trace the contamination, so that if they see a piece of DNA that lacks a certain fingerprint of ancient DNA, they can discard it. So they're able to identify and remove contamination.
And how old are we talking about here when we talk about ancient DNA? What are some of the older sequences that have been sequenced at this point?
It gets really old. The oldest so far to date is from a horse, and that's 700,000 years old.
Wow.
The oldest from a human is 440,000 years old. Now, that's not a full genome. That's a mitochondrial genome, the smaller genome from the mitochondria in the cell. And that's from a place called the Pit of Bones in northern Spain. And then the oldest full genome of our species, Homo sapiens, is 45,000 years old from Siberia.
And what are some of the big cases or questions that ancient DNA has helped us to crack? What have we learned about the past from this technique?
Well, my favorite, actually, is about who shagged who in the Paleolithic. For years, people have known that there used to be a number of different kinds of humans. There were our ancestors, early modern humans. There were the Neanderthals who lived in Europe. And there was also this mysterious species, which was first identified with ancient DNA, called the Denisovans, who were in Asia and perhaps Southeast Asia. For years, researchers argued about whether or not these kinds of humans, when they met each other, did they interbreed, especially when it came to the Neanderthals and modern humans. Researchers who studied skulls argued and argued over this. And then finally, the ancient DNA came along, and they sequenced the genome of a Neanderthal, and they confirmed that Neanderthals are indeed distinct from our species, but they also found that we have some Neanderthal DNA. So you and I and most living humans carry some Neanderthal DNA, and that's because our ancestors and the Neanderthals mixed it up in the Paleolithic.
Why can't we go back further in time? We talked about the oldest example, which is about 700,000 years, but why can't we go back even further?
Because time is the enemy of DNA. What happens over time is that various chemical processes attack the molecule. DNA is actually a really fragile molecule. Water, for example, will attack its chemical bonds. So usually when the researchers find ancient DNA, they don't find the long sequences that you would find in a living cell or a recently dead cell. Instead, they find the DNA all chopped up into small bits. They've gotten really good at putting those small bits together, but there is a limit.
Mm-hmm. A big hurdle to sequencing ancient DNA has been temperature. Hot is bad for DNA, just like water is bad for DNA. And it's kind of created a geographical bias in the findings. Most of the ancient DNA samples that have been sequenced have been from the farther northern reaches of the world. Is that going to change anytime soon?
You know, that's exactly right. And we have a map in the issue showing the most important ancient DNA samples, say, from humans, early humans. And you can see it's all the Northern Hemisphere because cold temperatures do indeed help the preservation of DNA because they slow the breakdown process that I was just discussing. However, there are people who are trying to get DNA from the tropics because there's all kinds of interesting questions they'd like to answer from the tropics. And they've had a few successes. They found, for example, that sometimes, perhaps, if you have samples in a cave environment, caves tend to be at least a relatively steady temperature, and often sometimes cooler than the outside. Those combination of things can help. They've also looked for places where DNA seems to be particularly well preserved, like in the plaque on your teeth. The plaque on your teeth retains bacteria and things inside it, and so you can look at that plaque and find out what people were eating, find out about their microbiome, those kinds of things. And so people are hopeful that that kind of research may work in the tropics.
That brings up the next question I was going to ask, which is, we've mostly talked about animals and people, but researchers are also looking at ancient DNA from plants and bacteria. What kinds of insights have they gained from this more environmental DNA approach?
So this environmental DNA approach is this extremely cool technique. What they do is they actually will take a scoop of soil or ice, ancient soil or ice, and they will chemically filter out everything but the DNA, and then they'll sequence whatever they've got in there. Now, sometimes they do put in probes. They'll say, okay, I want to look at the plants or I want to look at the bacteria. But they'll basically get a whole sample of whatever was in their little scoop of soil. And they've been able to do amazing things. They're sort of reconstructing ancient worlds from just, you know, a teaspoon-sized sample of soil. One example is that they've learned that just after the last ice age, if you look at the plants that survived, the world was warming, so you think that would be great. But what happened is that new plants came in, and the old plants that were adjusted to the cold, dry conditions, these were some plants called forbs that were found in the Arctic, those plants began to die off, and that was bad for the big grazing animals that you used to find in the Arctic at that time. And so that might have played a role in their extinction.
How does ancient DNA, being able to access whole genomes from such a long time ago, how does that fit together with what we've done with fossils and bones and carbon dating? Is it just going to be another tool in the arsenal?
Yes, exactly. Over time, it will be another tool in the arsenal. You know, when people look at an ancient site, supposing you're going to an ancient archaeological site, archaeologists look at all kinds of things. They look at the human bones. They look at whatever artifacts were buried with people. But they also look at the plants and animals around. They look at absolutely everything. And they also look at isotopes and things that will help them understand the past temperature. And they look at radiocarbon dating to find out how old the site is. And so some people say that over time, as part of that, people will also, for example, take a scoop of the soil and get ancient DNA from the soil. People will also try to get ancient DNA from all those animal bones so that they'll be able to have a bigger picture of the environment and they can put it all together. That's in the future. They can't do that yet. Okay?
Right.
So now what happens is that the ancient DNA researchers are working closely with archaeologists and other students of the past to understand what's going on. But in the future, they hope that it may be kind of a standardized technique.
Last, I want to talk about one potential method for digging much deeper into the past, paleoproteomics. the study of ancient proteins. Why might this be a more fertile ground for ancient research?
Because proteins are stronger or hardier than DNA. As I said, DNA is a fragile molecule, but proteins are tougher. In fact, they have been able to show that they were able to recover intact protein from 300 million-year-old fish fossils. So that's really a lot older, just amazing. Now, they haven't been able to sequence those proteins yet. So this field of paleoproteomics is really in its infancy compared to the field of ancient DNA. But some researchers are looking at it because this may be the next thing on the horizon. They need to improve their methods for sequencing, but they're excited about the possibilities.
Elizabeth, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
Check out our special issue on ancient DNA this week, edited by Elizabeth Culotta and featuring stories by her and other writers from our news team at www.sciencemag.org. And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org or tweet to us at Science Magazine. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and many other places, or listen to us on the Science site. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us. This week's episode is brought to you in part by Science Careers. Looking for some career advice? Wondering how to get ahead or how to strike a better work-life balance? Visit our site to read how others are doing it. Use our individual development plan tool, access topic-specific article collections, or search for an exciting new job. Science Careers, produced by Science and AAAS, is a free website full of resources to help get the most out of your career. Visit sciencecareers.org today to get started.